Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto of the National Speleological Society. The NSS is a national organization dedicated to the study, exploration, and preservation of caves and karst resources. If you are new to cave exploration, what we call caving, what some people call spelunking, we don't, but some people do. There's some debate as to the difference between a caver and a spelunker, but it's really weird, boring, inside baseball type stuff. The point is, we like to go into caves for one reason or another. There are some people who do it very seriously. They explore and map virgin caves. I love talking to those kinds of people, but I'm not one myself. I've never gotten the chance. I'm more of a recreational caver. I visit the same caves over and over again and just go through them for fun, kind of like hiking or paddling, just an extreme outdoor type activity that's a very unique experience for a certain kind of person. Maybe you're that kind of person. If you think that's the case, I would encourage you to get educated before you try it out. Hook up with the right people, join your local grotto, and start going to meetings. Most grottos meet monthly. Mine does. I should explain, a grotto is a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. There you'll meet people who will take you caving. You'll learn what you need to do it right. And you may just form some lifelong friendships the way that I have. Cavers are a tight-knit group. They look after each other. Remember, caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. But if you do and you're with people who do, it's just as safe as almost anything else. Maybe not quite as safe as sitting at home in front of your TV, but then again, depending on your taste in junk food, maybe it's even safer. Anyway, join your grotto, join the NSS, go to meetings, get underground. This month, I thought I'd try something a little different. If you've been listening to the podcast, first of all, thank you. Second, and the point I'm making here is that the usual format is a single in-person interview with a caver edited and presented for your listening pleasure. This month's episode was an idea that was handed to me by the show's sponsor, Scott McRae of Swago. He makes cave packs and other various caving accessories. And he did a series of short phone interviews with prominent cavers back before the 2009 NSS annual convention to get a history of cave packs so he could do a presentation on it at convention. He had these interviews sitting around on his hard drive, gathering digital dust, as it were, and he sent them to me and he said, hey, maybe you can make something out of these. So that's what this episode is about. We're going to hear from six prominent longtime cavers, many of whom have made and sold caving gear, including packs. Scott talked to them about their first packs, designing packs, and I think these conversations turned into some really interesting content. So I took them and I edited them and made them into this episode. And as a bonus, I also called Scott himself and asked him many of the same questions he asked his other guests and got the history of Swago, the reason he's had to suspend the manufacturer of his very unique and effective cave packs. A very interesting story indeed. Stand by for that. Of course, we're sponsored by Swago, but since we'll be talking with Scott later in the show, I'll let that serve as this month's sponsor mention because I think he speaks for himself quite well. And a quick calendar note. What are you doing this weekend? Yes, August 4th through the 6th is Indiana Cave Capers, my grotto's annual event. If you can make it, we'd sure love to have you. We're doing it at the Harrison County Fairgrounds, which is practically right in downtown Corydon, Indiana, Indiana's first state capital. The fairgrounds practically sits right on top of Indiana's longest cave, Binkley, and we'll have several lead trips through Binkley, including some of the more recent discoveries. We've got a great program that night on some of Binkley's the work being done in Binkley, and that'll be put on by Laura Demarest and Marion Akers and a few other cavers working on that project. By the way, those are two cavers who have told me that they'd love to be on the podcast, so stay tuned for their episodes. I can't wait to talk to them. And it's not just a Binkley Cave weekend. We've also got a huge list of approved caves for this year's event. Horizontal and vertical will have maps and descriptions in the guidebook. The area's got some really nice pits. So we'd love to see you in Indiana this weekend if you can make it. We'll have registration set up by Friday afternoon. You pay at the gate. You get your wristband. You come see some of the best caves Indiana has to offer. And as I said, it's right across the creek from downtown Corydon, where there's plenty of shops and restaurants, plus great show caves nearby, free access to the community pool. There's hiking nearby, so it'll be fun for cavers and non-cavers alike. Bring the whole family. We'll have Intermountain Outfitters on site. Come to the jam session Friday night, hosted by Ron Adams. Great times in Indiana this weekend. Indiana Cave Capers 2017, Harrison County Fairgrounds in Corydon, Indiana, August 4th through the 6th. I will personally see you there. That said, I will also be conducting quick, impromptu caving podcast interviews near the registration desk at various times throughout the weekend, and interviewees will get a free caving podcast t-shirt. These were designed and printed up by my good friend Charlie Vetters, who also runs an Etsy shop for caving and outdoor-related apparel. And his shirts have won salon awards at the NSS convention. And you should check him out. His Etsy store is called Organic Robot. That's all one word, Organic Robot. And if you're at Capers this weekend, we'll have some of his shirts near registration for you to peruse. All right, packs. What was your first pack? Mine was a backpack that I filled to the brim with stuff I didn't need, and it got pretty wrecked in a 1,200-foot crawlway. These days, I use a red Gonzo Guano for short trips and, of course, my Swago for long trips. So in this episode, we'll hear from NSS historian Craig Heineman, former NSS president and member of My Grotto, Tom Ray, former owner of Lost Creek Packs and current national coordinator of the National Cave Rescue Commission, Anmar Mirza, founder of Intermountain Outfitters, Alex Sproul, and former pack maker and founder of Howie's Harnesses, Howie Cobb. And then, of course, we'll close it all out with my conversation with Scott McRae about Swago. Now, I've got to warn you, some of the audio on these phone calls isn't the best. I did what I could to make them clear and easy to hear, but some of the audio was tough to salvage. I will say that the longest phone interview in this episode is just over 8 minutes. So if you don't like the quality of a particular interview, it won't last long. Now, the first of these phone interviews kind of segue into each other nicely, but I'll jump back in after those to introduce the rest of them. So without further ado, let's start with Swago founder Scott McRae talking with NSS historian Craig Heineman.
Your letter to me intrigued me.
Yeah.
Because I don't remember that much or even that many inquiries about packs.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was refreshing that somebody was coming up with something new to research.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Usually the inquiries I get are about expedition or something like that. But there is some military gas mask packs and we really didn't have a first aid kit pack, but there were also some little packs that were belt-mounted on webbing belts. They may have been ammo packs or something like that. But those are all out of the late 40s, early 50s, after the guys came back from the war. Everybody's caving in the ballistic cloth coveralls now, but there for the longest time, it was all military fatigue that people were caving in. Although there were some a group out of Pennsylvania that came up with a Shazam suit that was a rubberized cloth that they used to, that they vulcanized together and actually built coveralls out of it. The original Shazam suits all had a lightning bolt on them. But even Petzl didn't get into packs until late. And they came out with some packs after their helmets and after their lamps.
Okay.
Early on, and I'm not even sure where he's at now. Bill Nelson, Willie Nelson, old Virginia caver, went to Michigan, then to Tennessee, and I think he's back in West Virginia, but I'm not real sure. We found one of his packs in a cave in Virginia, and he happened to be at a bar.
Yeah.
And when we came back with it, what they were Prince Albert cans, and they were little aluminum, because he worked for Alcoa Aluminum, sort of looked like snuff boxes. That screwed together. And we came back and we said, look what we found. And he goes, damn, those are mine. And we sat there and said, sure, right. And so while we were opening them up, we said, well, hell, if they're yours, what's in them? And he named everything except the red crayon in the little aluminum box. He had magnesium ribbon in there to where you could light that. Yeah. And those were his original packs, but he used to carry them in his pants pockets. And supposedly he lost these things around 54, 55.
Yeah.
And here we found him in 83.
Wow.
But the one thing he didn't mention that was in his little pack was that red crayon for marking his NSS number on the at the end of his exploration inside the cave.
Huh. What cave did you find him in?
It was a nothing little cave. There were seven of them. They really didn't have names, and since then we've just named them the seven small caves along the South River.
Okay.
But it's there in Grottoes, Virginia.
That's cool.
Yeah. We were amazed that he could remember everything that was in them. Including a little plastic whistle, blue and white whistle. He even named the colors of it.
Wow.
That was used in the first sound connection between Finn and Thorn Cave over in West Virginia.
Huh.
But it was amazing. And he'd have four or five of these little aluminum containers that he just packed stuff in and shoved them in his pocket.
Huh.
Tom Ray had a lot to do with the Russians when they came over. Hello?
Hey, Tom, this is Scott McRae.
Hi.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, fine.
Okay, great. So what was your first caving pack?
I was kind of trying to remember. I think the first time I went, I just had some kind of a gas mask bag, a canvas gas mask bag.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, just something with a shoulder strap.
Right.
And it wasn't very good for that.
Right.
And then I found a rubber, I think it was a gas mask bag. It was Army Surplus. They had a whole bunch of them at the Army Surplus store. They were rubberized thing. Look, it was the shape and size of a briefcase,
uh-huh.
You know, sort of flat and
right.
Wide. But it rolled up, the top rolled down, and then it snapped, and it was kind of waterproof. I mean, it was cave waterproof for sure.
Yeah.
It would not be scuba diving. And they had about 50 of those, and I bought them all.
Wow.
For 10 cents a piece.
Okay.
And sold them around the grotto, and everybody used them for a while.
Huh. When was that?
Oh, that was probably about early 60s.
Okay.
I used that for a long time until I wore them all out.
Yeah.
Then I don't remember what. I wound up finally with a Lost Creek pack, and I had a prototype Lost Creek pack. It had a seam around the middle of it that they don't have anymore. That you just started making them. And I bought one of those. I don't remember whether I had anything in between the rubber gas mask bag and the Lost Creek pack or not. But
okay.
I've had a Lost Creek pack of one kind or another ever since then.
Okay. What do you think the earliest caving pack was? I mean, not necessarily a pack produced commercially, but, you know.
People used?
Yeah.
I don't have any idea. You'd have to have somebody older than me.
Okay.
I got into organized caving in 61.
Okay.
And it was going pretty good by then.
Right.
Most people just had some kind of a canvas thing that they picked up somewhere at the Army Surplus store.
Uh-huh.
The cave pack was never a big thing for me. Like, you know, I got interested in packs. It was just, I got to carry my shit. What am I going to carry?
Yeah.
Once I found the Lost Creek packs, I quit. But I've worn out a couple of them. They're pretty tough.
Yes, they are. All right. What would be the strangest caving pack you've seen or heard of?
I think the strangest ones are those pig things that they make out of two plastic bleach bottles. You know, they
right.
push them together.
Yep. Yep.
Those are weird.
Yeah. Yes, they are.
I think that's probably the strangest one I ever saw. If it wasn't a gurney can, but
yeah.
a gurney can almost makes sense. For a crawlway.
Yep. What about some references for cave pack history? Anything you can recommend?
I gave you a couple names in the email.
Yep. All right. Yeah, I talked to Anmar last night.
When I met Anmar, he was just a kid running around on a motorcycle. He's not old enough to know a lot of history unless somebody's told it to him.
Right. Hey, Anmar. Scott McRae.
Hey, Scott.
How are you?
Not too bad. How are you doing?
Good. Just start at the top. What was your first caving pack?
My first caving pack was a World War II surplus gas mask pack.
Okay.
It cost $2 at the local Army Navy.
All right. That seems to be what most people's answer is.
But as soon as you got any mud in the closures, they stopped working.
Right. So what was your second cave pack?
My second one was one that I had made myself. It was made out of canvas, and I don't really remember how I closed it, but it might have been Fast X Buckles, but I'm not sure.
What's the earliest caving pack that you are familiar with?
As far as a commercially available caving pack?
No, not necessarily.
Or
I mean,
in general.
Yeah, it could be, you know, something Floyd Collins used or even earlier than that.
When I started caving, a lot of people were who didn't have, like, you know, the Lost Creek packs at the time. This would have been the early 1980s. A lot of people were using those military gas mask packs, or they were using what they called a pig, which was two bleach bottles with the bottom cut out and one slid inside the other. And the earliest packs that I know of, as far as you know, what general cavers use, usually military surplus packs of some sort.
What do you guess the first commercially produced caving pack was?
You know, the earliest one that I know of is the Frisch pack, which was the precursor to Lost Creek.
What's the strangest thing you've ever seen used as a cave pack?
Well, in Mammoth Cave, there were these things that I can only describe. They kind of looked like the tops of missiles. They were about 2 foot in diameter, and they were about 3 to 4 feet long, and they were made out of sheet metal, and people were using them for camping in the cave, and they put all this stuff inside of them. It had no bottom to it, and they'd drag them behind them in the you know, the big walking passages and the crawlways and the like.
Is that a gurney can?
I'm not sure, because I know the gurney can came along sometime in that time period, but I'm not sure if it was either a precursor to it or a copy of it.
Oh, okay.
I also caved with a guy who used a heavy gauge aluminum. It's called a powder can. It's designed for black powder, and the thing was about the size of a 2 gallon jar, basically, and had screw top lids. And the guy kept all of his caving equipment in it. The thing was heavy as hell.
Nice. That's good. What about internationally? Have you noticed differences in U.S. caving packs and packs they use overseas?
It seems to be pretty universal as far as the European cavers go, that the Petzl, you know, the basic round PVC with, you know, single strap and sometimes double straps. But it seems like the Petzl equipment, both in caving packs and pretty much everything that I know of the Europeans use, seems to be predominant. You know, I've caved with a bunch of the European cavers, including the Polish cavers when they came over, some Russian cavers back in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, I guess. And they all seem to have those yellow Petzl packs.
Could you tell me a little bit about the history of Lost Creek?
Well, a guy by the name of Tom Fritsch, F-R-I-T-S-C-H, started making cave packs. And this would have been about 1976 or 77. And he was making them basically in his basement and was selling them at caving events. And then kind of got a little bit bigger and started selling them to Bob and Bob and Ian Ellis from Spelio Shop. And I don't know exact dates on these, but by the early 80s, he had was actually marketing them as Lost Creek packs.
All right.
And then he died, I want to say it was like 84 or 85, and the Don Paquette took her. He basically rebuilt Lost Creek packs, and he and his girlfriend Joellen Kimmel ran it for several years, and then Bill Bouse bought it from Don. I want to say probably early 90s.
Okay.
And then he owned it for 7 or 8 years, and then he'd actually approached me several times for 5 or 6 years before I bought it about purchasing it. He then sold it to a retired couple who weren't cavers, And I don't think they had any idea what they were getting into.
Yeah.
They owned it for 8 months. And a friend of mine who was a caver who worked for them said that they were very highly motivated to sell. And that's when I purchased it in 2000, spring of 2000.
All right.
So you were wanting to know about significant developments in caving packs over the years.
Right, okay.
The one big development that I think has made caving packs probably as ubiquitous as they are now is the development of the side-release Fastex buckle, Fastex-style buckle.
Huh, okay.
Because up to that point, there were no real good options for clipping caving packs.
Interesting. Good thought. Okay.
Everything else that I'd known of was too prone to getting mud and grit in them.
Right.
And then you've got a question here about what does my crystal ball show me about caving packs in the future?
Right.
The biggest development that I see coming out in the future are some of these hybrid fabrics that are they're like the shark skin type fabrics.
Right.
Where they're waterproof, but they're basically covered with a plate of some sort. And really, as far as the design of cave packs go, there's only you're a manufacturer, there's only a few basic designs that you can have.
Right.
And so I don't really see a lot of change in design of cave packs, but I do see improvements and advances in the wear resistance and waterproofness of material.
Right. Okay.
I think one of the big advances that you've been part of has been the sealing of you use an ultrasonic sealing, right?
It's radio frequency.
A welding for yours?
Yep.
Yeah. I see that as a big development for that type of material that you're using. But as far as like the designs of the packs, I don't really see a whole lot of area that they can go.
Right. Well, very good. Well, I appreciate your time.
Sure thing, man.
That was former owner of Lost Creek Packs, Anmar Mirza. He's an Indiana caver. He's also the national coordinator of the National Cave Rescue Commission. Before that, former NSS president Tom Ray and NSS historian Craig Heinemann kick things off. Boy, was I surprised at how many people use gas mask bags. I've got one, too. I've got a rubberized Russian bag, I think. I used it just last year on a short trip. Okay, now we'll hear from the guy who started the caving retailer Intermountain Outfitters, Alex Sproul.
What was your first caving pack?
An M18 Army gas mask bag, what everybody used in those days.
Yeah. Is that one of the ones that's lined?
No, it kind of had stays in the side of it.
Okay.
It was designed to go over your shoulder and around your waist.
Right.
And then ripped it open with those three little snappies and could go right into it.
Okay. Is that the one that fell open all the time?
Mine never did.
Oh, okay. I had one years ago that continually opened and dumped all my stuff out.
Addition of the little wires in the snaps.
Oh, that could be.
You dragged it upside down over a sharp place, yeah, they could catch, pull it open, but
yeah,
generally had my snaps up under my elbow, so but never a problem.
When was that?
Well, I started in 58 to probably, I was still using it in Huntsville in 1970.
What was your second cave pack?
Been Lost Creek ever since.
Yeah. So what's the earliest caving pack you know of?
M18 gas mask bag.
Really?
Right. I'm trying to think of pictures I've seen of the Robinson photos and all from back when. And I think they all used Army surplus stuff, too.
Yeah.
Because, we started in 40, 41 when all that stuff was plentiful.
Right. Okay. Do you know what, like, Floyd Collins and Stephen Bishop, that era, what they used?
Again, I would have to rely on photographs or drawings, and I seem to recall Bishop having something over his shoulder, but I don't know what it was. I'm sure Floyd carried supplies with him, but I have no idea in what.
And do you know what the first specifically commercial produced caving pack was?
I think that had to be the Lost Creek.
Really? Okay. All right.
It
by Tom Fritsch.
Yeah. I guess somewhere in here there should be mention of the gurney can, which was not really a cave pack, but a means of getting all your crap back into the cave intact.
Right. Do you know what year that was, roundabout?
C3 Expedition in 53. That's okay. When it was invented.
What's the strangest thing you've seen used for a cave pack?
Well, it would probably be two Clorox bottles put together.
Yeah. Heard people call that a pig. Is that what you call it?
Yeah. 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 They cut the bottoms out of two and put them together and tie a rope and hang it around their shoulder.
Right.
That's a Kentucky cave pack.
Oh, okay. What do you consider the significant developments in cave packs over the years?
Well, there haven't been that many, actually. Tom Fritsch pretty much scored the first cave unique pack, and everybody else has kind of taken off on that design and added a few bells and whistles, mostly Howie and Mike Arts.
Okay.
Both contributed to the refinement of that basic roll-down top design, but always with straps rather than the circle around buckle.
Right.
Which you and Becky have come up with.
Right.
Actually, Howie did some circle arounds too. I don't know who did that first, the roll and tuck, which is really kind of handy because it makes great handle and
Make
sure you know which way is up and out.
Right. What's your crystal ball say about caving packs in the future?
I don't know. I think these guys at Swago pretty well got it nailed.
Yeah.
The real development is that what we need to take along is getting smaller and lighter, so there's less need for as much pack as we used to have to tote.
Right.
Those expedition bags that Becky makes are just, I would never want to have to carry one of those things.
Yeah.
Especially full as they could be.
Yep. Yep.
A lech pack? No, thank you.
Yep.
I think I would find a way to travel lighter than that.
Yeah, me too.
Or hire two or three Sherpas to carry my camp gear.
Yeah, that's right.
Intermountain Outfitters founder Alex Sproul talking to Swago founder Scott McRae. And you heard him mention Howie toward the end there. Let's hear from Howie Cobb from Howie's Harnesses right now. And a warning, this is probably the worst audio I've got, but I thought Howie had some really interesting insight. So try to put up with the poor quality initially. I did my best with it. Here's Howie.
So I guess, can you start with the history of Howie's Harnesses and making packs?
I started Howie's Harnesses in December of 1990, started vending at Sarah in 91. And, you know, from more ago, I made, like, accessory-type packs, you know, along the lines of, like, hey, Sam Swago, you know, more, you know, they were made of Cordura and heavily coated materials. But there were more accessory bags to go inside of packs. I didn't make full-blown packs. And we bought state-of-the-art mountaineering in 1999. And most of the designs that we sew are from state-of-the-art.
Okay.
We started offering different versions of the Vampire Pack and started offering all of the packs in a Shazam version, with the Shazam material. You know, the only pack that we designed from the ground up is the Marsupium. It's like a survey, you know, it's made for a survey book and instruments and stuff like that. And it was somewhat of a knockoff of a gas mask bag. We were getting a lot of requests for a gas mask bag.
Right. Let me ask you a couple of questions about overall cave pack history. What was your first caving pack?
Oh, it was a gas mask bag.
Oh, okay. When was that?
Oh, 88.
88, okay.
Yeah. And, you know, it was practicality and availability. It's handy, I know, you know, I'm used to it. I've always said that I would replace those accursed metal buckles and cotton webbing with fast X's and nylon straps, and I never have. You know, it's one of those, you know, the only thing about fixing the window when it's raining.
Right.
You know what I mean? A lot of caving stuff has evolved from what we had in terms of availability, you know, with the outdoor market and with Army Surplus. You know, there were people like Ted Burke who knocked off Lost Creeks, and he would pretty much, you know, make anything that you wanted. You know, if you wanted a little short, squat butt pack, well, he'd make you one.
Huh.
You know, and he just did it on the side. I have his machine now. It's kind of fun.
Okay.
But, yeah, I think that
I would like to see more, you know, and I don't want to make the suggestion that I get every Yahoo in the country wanting a dual custom pack made, but I'd like to see more input by cavers.
Yeah.
You know, any pack that is going in or out of Letch needs either a space for a dry bag for your burritos,
right,
or a, like, a hermetically sealed pouch on the bean. You know, I mean, that needs to be accounted for.
Right.
External bottle holders, easy accessibility to vertical gear. You know, there are a lot of things that need to be incorporated into the pack.
Yeah, right.
And I'd like to see more cavers, you know, have input.
Yeah.
You know.
So, what was your second cave pack?
It was a pack rat with a mic. It was a mic art. It was a pack rat.
Okay. So what's the earliest caving pack you know of?
Like, produced for caving.
Well, not necessarily. And what's the first cave pack, you know, like, what did Floyd Collins carry, or Stephen Bishop?
Right. Okay. I mean, I went caving in when I was nine, so it was going to be like 1972 or 3,
uh-huh,
to Cumberland Caverns. And the guy who was our leader had two pigs. One was Clorox bottles, and the other one was like Stay Puft bottles or something.
Okay.
And he kept all of his carbide charges and his cleaning kit and tips and everything and the little Stay Puft pig. And all of his other stuff was in the big pig, you know, okay, made out of Clorox bottles.
Yeah.
And I was just really impressed, you know. I mean, he said, yeah, he wore them out every, like, 10 trips, but, you know, it was two Clorox bottles,
yeah,
you know. So, I mean, I think that is my earliest memory of somebody taking something specifically for caving that I'd not seen elsewhere.
Okay. So what do you think the first commercially produced caving pack was, specifically for caving?
Yeah, it would be out of my hiney. You know, I mean, I would guess that it was a Lost Creek in the early to mid-80s.
Okay.
There have been, like Dragon. You know, UK.
It's right.
It's a really old company. They've been making cave packs since the late 70s. You know, but I didn't, you know, I've only found that out in the last 5 years.
So, what's the strangest thing you've seen used for a caving pack?
I'm going to think about that for a second. Oh, for sure. Beer sleeve.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
you know, the ones that you put, like, the six pack, like, stacked up inside of them.
Yeah, sure.
That's definitely, that was it.
Huh. Where'd you see that?
At Carsterama.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like this guy pulled, like, he pulled carbide and a can of soda and, you know, I mean, maybe some vertical equipment. I mean, the whole, you know, he had like three of them, and that's what he exclusively used for cave bags. You know, it was during the days of camel cash.
Yeah.
You know, and you'd get one of those things for, like, you know, 30 camel bucks or something,
right,
like that. You know,
right,
and they were everywhere.
Have you noticed any difference in how international caving packs are different from U.S.?
They have more of a tendency to be with whatever materials they had available.
Okay.
You know, I've seen packs made of inner tubes.
I've heard that quite a few Brits especially don't carry cave packs at all.
Well, they just put it in pockets and stuff?
Yeah. Have you heard that too?
Well, you know, I mean, yes, I have. I've heard that.
Okay.
I mean, aside from the fact that you're going to have an oversized suit to, like, carry all this crap,
right,
you know what I mean? And this is going to sound, you know, more of the Brits that I know are skinny little scrawny guys.
Yeah.
That you know, they'd have plenty of room in a cave suit to do that.
Yeah.
The biggest issue, you know, having done it myself, is falling on it.
Yeah.
You know, you have, like, anything. You can have a ballpoint pen get turned and fall on it and kill yourself.
Right.
You know, I mean, right. I know it sounds paranoid, but I'm just saying that I wouldn't want to be carrying all my stuff on my person like that. You know, what if you fall down a crevasse and the webbing you need is, like, behind you where you can't get it?
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, for the same fact, you could have dropped your cave pack on the same crevasse and can't get that either.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can think of more reasons to carry a cave pack than to not.
Right.
You know, and like I said, I don't care for a backpack because I tend to be a little bit of a monkey, and the weight, you can't keep a backpack very stabilized on your pack. It's kind of swinging.
Uh-huh.
And with a butt pack, with a shoulder strap, you can get it relatively secure, and the weight is more in the middle of your person. So if you're chimneying or climbing up something, you don't have this appendage you know, dragging you down with extra weight above your center of gravity.
Right, right. Any references for caving pack history, like in some books or other articles that have been written? Or
no, other than, like, you know, truly historical stuff. You know, you can get stuff, you know,
Stephen Bishop.
Bishop, there you go. He carried a side pack. You know, it was like, it was basically a burlap bag with a strap on it.
Okay.
You know, you can find historical references here and there.
Right.
Same thing with Floyd Collins.
Uh huh.
You know, I'm pretty sure, if not in Law and Trapped, in one of the books, it describes in detail what he's got in his pack.
Okay.
And why.
Right. All right. Well, I think that's about all I need.
All right, homie. Well, be good, be safe, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks again.
Howie Cobb of Howie's Harnesses. And, of course, last I heard, Howie isn't making anything anymore. This interview was recorded back in 2009. And a lot has changed since then. Swego has also since stopped making packs, but not because he wanted to. Swego founder Scott McRae tells us all about it right now in the final segment of this month's episode. Here is me and Scott. Scott, thanks for finally coming on the Caving Podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'll ask you what you asked all of them. What was your first cave pack?
So my first cave pack was a school book bag, you know, with a zipper and cheap materials, and it lasted, I don't know, 4 or 5 trips probably before it started. The zipper would jam, and the straps wouldn't work anymore. You know, you couldn't adjust them, and you know, started getting holes in it, so it didn't last very long.
Did you take that pack on your first cave trip, or did you do your first cave trip packless?
Probably my first trip was packless. I think I was 12 years old in the Boy Scouts, and I don't remember wearing helmets or anything, so I'm sure we didn't have packs, but I'm pretty sure we used flashlights, actually.
What would you say then was your first serious cave pack, one that you bought because it was a cave pack?
Yeah, my first, serious cave pack was a Lost Creek. I think it's called a Caver Special. It was a pretty small, about the size, it seems like it was about the size of a gallon milk jug, probably. And I used that for, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 years when I first started caving with the Cleveland Grotto, and then moved down to North Carolina with the Flittermouse Grotto, and I used it here too. But that got too small once we started doing some survey and more exploration rather than just tourist caves. So I got somebody gave me a Lost Creek tag pack, I think they're called. It's about twice the size of the first one I had. So that was nice to be able to carry some more stuff. So yeah, that was my first serious cave pack.
I guess I'd like to ask, this question, because I remember you asking some of those other guys, what do you think is the strangest thing you've ever seen used as a cave pack?
The Clorox bottle pigs, they always amuse me.
I would say that's my answer too. Seems like a decent enough idea, but seems a little cumbersome at the same time.
Yeah. I saw somebody use antifreeze jugs the same way.
A little bigger.
Except they're, instead of being round, they're, you know, kind of rectangle shape. So
yeah.
I don't know if that'd be a more efficient shape or not, but interesting adaption, I guess.
It's a bizarre, but somehow useful system.
Yeah.
Can you walk me through the genesis of Swego, like the inspiration, the design, testing them out?
You know, dragging that Lost Creek pack around, they're great packs, but they have some faults. We were doing a lot of East Tennessee caves, but lots of stream crawls, and the pack is basically a sponge, so it would absorb a lot of water and get heavy, and of course it's not waterproof, so you had to carry either a dry bag or trash bags or something to put all your stuff inside the pack, and that was, you know, just a pain, made the pack heavier, and also got really frustrated with all the straps hanging off of it, especially when you're trying to push a pack through a belly crawl and the straps get caught on everything, and they're just flapping everywhere. It annoyed me. So eventually I just said, I'm just going to make one. So I got some material from like Joann Fabric or some fabric store that had PVC on one side, just a thin coating of PVC, and then I think it was just nylon on the other side. So I sewed something up that was kind of like a dry bag shape. I knew I wanted it to be kind of flat so it didn't stick out from my back too much, to keep it low profile, and sewed the straps into the seam so there weren't any buckles, and made them so they were not adjustable, so there weren't any sliders or anything like that, to simplify it some more, and used a regular roll down closure with a clip to close that. So in theory, it would have been pretty water resistant. You know, it was just sewn together, so the seams weren't waterproof, but got that made up, and yeah, I thought it was pretty cool. So we took it out to a cave in East Tennessee called Holt, and it's got a 1,000-foot entrance crawl through a stream. And I was all excited, wouldn't have to take a dry bag inside my pack anymore. So we pulled it in there, and it did okay. We got in and did our survey and dragged it back out, and started looking at it when we got out, and it was just full of holes. The material was way too weak and thin to support that kind of abuse. So back to the drawing board. Actually had that pack. I wanted to show another caving buddy of mine, Kevin Quick. We were getting together that following weekend for a wedding shower for a buddy of ours. So I took the pack and showed him, and he's like, yeah, that's pretty cool. And he tried it on, and he put it on upside down. And I was like, yeah, you dummy. And then, I had that aha moment. I looked at that pack upside down on his back. I was like, whoa, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I went back to the drawing board and got some heavier duty material, actually called I was doing some research on the internet and found a company, I think it was in California, that made pond liners, to line like fish ponds. And they are using some pretty heavy duty material. So I just called them up out of the blue and said, hey, could I get some scraps? And they said, sure, no problem. And they mailed me like a yard or two. So I cut some out and sewed it together, kind of in the shape of what a Swago pack looks like now. Took a picture and sent it back to this lady from the company, and she was very interested, wanted to see what I was doing. And she said, oh, honey, you can't sew that. Send it back to me, and I'll weld the seams for you. And I was like, what are you talking about? You can't weld fabric. I was thinking like metal. And she's like, no. So I sent her, cut out another pack shape and sent it back, and she welded it, sent it back to me. I was like, wow, this is great. So, just some little happenings like that various people showed me how to do improvements to the packs that I just kept piling on. I wanted a grommet at the top of the pack so the straps would slide through to make it kind of adjustable. I was thinking that you might be able to sling it over one shoulder, wear it kind of like a side pack or backpack. So I wanted that grommet to be able to slide. And I couldn't find a grommet big enough for 1-inch webbing to go through. So I went down to, there's a tack shop at the local cowboy store, I guess, where you get cowboy boots and hats and farm horse stuff. But they had a tack shop in the basement where you get your saddles and leather work repaired. They had some grommets, ended up having one of those 3/4-inch diameter, which is what I need. They put a couple of grommets in for me, and I was showing the guy how it's going to work. And he's like, well, if you take a bite of that webbing, stick it through the grommet, and then put your carabiner on the other side of the grommet, that'll make it stronger. So that way the force on the grommet is actually all the way around the whole circumference of the grommet rather than just on one side. If you just fish the webbing through the hole and pulled on it, you'd get a lot of stress on one side of the grommet. So you stick the bite through with the beaner on the other side, you get that force all the way around the grommet. I was like, hey, that's a good idea. So I tried that, and I took it home and, made it up that way. And I was showing it to somebody, and I just grabbed that carabiner, and the strap fed through the grommet and the pack dropped to the ground. Like, whoa, hey, instant tether. So that's kind of how that accidentally happened. Somebody, oh, the closure. Closure is kind of unique in dry bags. I call it the tuck and roll closure because there's a piece of coated webbing that goes across the opening of the pack. And it's welded on so that there's kind of a flap. So you actually tuck the opening of the bag underneath the flap of this coated webbing. You tuck that under there and then roll it down. So that's the tuck and roll closure. You know, most dry bags, it's just the two pieces of material at the opening, and then you just roll that down. But the tuck part actually forces the opening closed and keeps it closed when you're rolling it shut. So you get a more positive seal on the closure. So somebody showed me that and said I could use it. So I rolled with it. And yeah, just little improvements like that kept coming and coming. And so ended up where we are today.
And so that pond liner material is essentially what you ended up using for?
No, actually, that actually turned out to be a PVC material. And the material that packs are made out of is a polyurethane material, which polyurethane coated material is about 4 times more durable than PVC coated material.
Ah.
So somebody showed me that too. Somebody locally had a scrap of this polyurethane material, and I was like, yeah, it's pretty cool. So I found out who the manufacturer was and contacted them. They sent me a sample, and you know, I could tell instantly it was wonderful stuff. So I figured out how I was going to be able to buy that and use it, and get it welded. Yeah, the whole welding issue was kind of interesting too.
I'm curious about how you weld it. Is it like a press, or is it like an actual, almost like a weld, like a metal weld?
Well, it's a press. Yeah, you have to create a die that's the shape of whatever the weld is going to be. So it's a piece of aluminum that gets machined out into whatever shape you want. In Swago case, it's kind of a U shape. So I had to get that machined, and then you take it to a company that has a welder. Luckily, there's one here in town, and they were willing to do a few packs for me just to prototype. So we did that and got the die made, and they made a few, but it's basically a big press, like you said, but it uses heat. So the die is actually heated, and you put the two pieces of material under the press, and it presses down, so it sits there for like 15 seconds and heats up the material, just gets it warm. And then you turn on the radio frequencies, which actually shoot through the material, and then whatever is in between gets really hot. So it's a very precise way to heat something, so you don't get a lot of bleed over on the heat, just concentrates the heat right on the die. So it's accurate and precise as far as, you know, you can adjust the temperature down to, you know, 1 degree plus or minus whatever you want. So it's very flexible that way. But so yeah, it's just a big press. It basically heats up whatever will melt, in this case the polyurethane, and it kind of marries the two pieces of material together.
That sounds very precise and fascinating.
Yeah.
Do you now do that part yourself, or do you send that out for?
Well, both. I end up taking the material. We cut it here in the basement, the Swago International headquarters, the basement of my house,
which is where you are right now. We're doing this as a FaceTime interview, and I'm seeing all of the stuff around you.
Right. Yeah. So I cut it all out here, and then take it to a company in South Carolina that actually manufactures their radio frequency welding machines. And they are kind enough to let me use their machine to weld the packs. So I don't actually set the machine up or press the button. Ah. I just feed them the material, and they put it in the machine and press the button, and then they pull it back out and give it back to me.
You just did several of them at a time? Like, so a batch then would be, you'd take how many to them and do them at a time?
Yeah, 50 to 100 at a time.
So am I correct in assuming then that all Swago packs have more or less been made by hand by you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yep.
I mean, I'm sure that that's the case with a lot of cave packs because it's a pretty small niche market.
Right.
But I don't know. I think that's kind of neat.
Yeah, actually, the only piece of a Swago pack that's not originated in the United States is the little beaners that come with them.
Yeah, just a little quick locks. Huh.
Yeah, evidently nobody in America makes those.
What?
Yeah, they could only find them from China.
Well, all right. You just order three colors and you're good to go.
Yeah.
So then can I ask what happened ahead of the 2015, the November announcement that Swago packs would be discontinued?
Sure, yeah. So I found talking to the manufacturer of the material, they had a customer that was using it. They're out in Vancouver, British Columbia, and they made collapsible kayaks that had an aluminum frame that you carry in a backpack and you take it to wherever you're going and you assemble the frame and then stretch the material over the kayak. So you have a collapsible, carryable kayak, a sea kayak, not a whitewater kayak.
Wow.
So they use that material on the hull of their kayaks. And actually, this company worked with the material manufacturer, to develop this material specific for their purpose. They needed something lightweight, relatively thin, but very, very abrasion resistant as you scrape the bottom of this kayak across rocks and drag it up through the sand and shore and through portages and whatever. So they needed great abrasion resistance, and most companies making collapsible kayaks were using PVC, and it just didn't hold up.
Right.
They made this stuff, and it worked great. So I contacted them, and originally they were sending me their scraps. They were cutting 18 to 24 foot long pieces to go on the hulls of these kayaks. So they'd have triangular shapes left over that were too small to do anything with. They used to buy rolls that were 50 yards long, and if they came up with the last piece was only 16 feet long, they couldn't use it. So I would buy all those scraps from them, and that worked for a while, and then started making too many Swago packs, and they couldn't keep up with my demand. So ended up just ordering full rolls. When this kayak company ordered their material, I would, add a couple of rolls onto their order. So that way I wouldn't have to worry about meeting the minimum order requirements. So that worked great for a while. And then in September of 2015, this kayak company sent me an email and said, "Hey, we're going to quit making that boat, moving on to other things." So that meant they didn't need that material anymore, which meant, the manufacturer was perfectly happy to make some more and sell it to me, but I would have to meet the minimum order requirements, which were huge.
Way more than you would possibly need.
Yeah, it would last me 20, 25 years worth of material. It'd be well more than I spent to buy my house.
Wow.
And it would probably fill my basement with material.
Yeah.
It's not just the money thing. It's logistics of where I would put it and how long it would take to use it. Yeah, it just wasn't going to work to buy that much material. So the natural option is, go find some other material. And I've literally searched the world. I've been all over the country at trade shows, fabric trade shows. Actually, I'm going to another one next week and looking for material that's can replace this. But there just isn't anything as good. I can't bring myself to use a lesser quality material on a pack just so I can start selling them again.
It wouldn't be the same.
No, you can't say, the packs are back. They're just not as good. I can't do that. So, So I either need to find a bunch of money in a warehouse or hopefully find something good or better.
That was going to be my other question. You've tried some other materials, but nothing's really come close enough.
Yeah. I've had some that, you have some of the qualities, like I've found some stuff that's really, really abrasion resistant, maybe even more abrasion resistant, but they're too stiff and you can't roll them down. Mm. Or, you know, just the opposite, that they're, you know, found some that roll down real nice, but not abrasion resistant enough, or the, you know, some of the samples I've gotten from China have been, you know, none of them have been good enough, but there was some that maybe I thought about using, and it's just the language barrier and the shipping and all the logistics of getting material from China in small batches that I would be using was just impossible. So it's been tough.
When did you start making the Swago pack that we know?
Well, we actually made the first prototype in 2001, and we used it for a couple of years. I think we made 3 or 4 and just used it amongst friends for a few years and made a few refinements. And then we got it to where we're pretty satisfied, and we sold the first packs retail in 2003. We consigned them with Intermountain Outfitters at OTR.
Surely you have heard from users. Maybe people have sent pictures or stories. Have Swago packs, I mean, obviously they've been in some pretty cool places, but have they been anywhere that you thought, wow, my pack went there? That's really cool.
Yeah. You know, they've been to China. Is always pretty cool to see pictures of packs in China. Found a picture on the internet, I think it was on Instagram about a year ago, probably. The folks that are going up into glacier caves up on like Mount Rainier and Mount St. Helens, studying the volcanic vents up there and the vent caves, I guess that's not what they're called, but holes in the ice and snow that are created by hot air coming out of the volcano, and it just melts a tube, an air shaft, basically, out of the mountain. So there's a picture, a really cool picture of a guy ice climbing up towards one of these vents, and he had a Swago pack on. So that was pretty neat. Oh, and also, I got a call. It's been, could have been 10 years ago. I don't remember exactly, but some folks down at Fort Bragg, the Army base in North Carolina, they were sending a unit over to Afghanistan to find caves in the hills of Afghanistan and map them and figure out what sort of assets or threats or whatever they have in these caves. So they sent, three other guys up to our grotto, and we spent a weekend with them teaching them how to survey caves. Then they ended up buying 6 Swago packs to take over there. You know, I was talking to them, like, what kind of gear are you going to be taking in these caves? And they had no idea. So I said, well, you might as well get some Swago packs. And they said, sure. Here's our credit card. I said, great.
Yes.
So they took 6 Swago packs to Afghanistan, and I told them specifically, I'm like, please let me know how these do. You know, send me a picture, some sort of feedback. And unfortunately, I never heard another word from them.
Oh, man.
So hopefully that's not a bad thing. But
yeah.
There are pictures of the prototypes and the stages of prototypes on the website. There's a history section if anybody wants to see the pictures of what the first few Swago packs looked like.
Check that out, swagogear.com. And of course, you've got pictures of the new prototypes with different materials that you kind of had put through the paces. None of them quite worked out real well, but I thought it was really interesting to follow that on the Swago Facebook page.
Right. Yeah, that's usually where I put stuff like that, the Facebook page. So,
yeah, if you want to keep up to date on Swago's progress, keep your eye on that Facebook page. Yep. And I really hope that eventually you're able to find something, and I'm sure you do too.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
The demand is out there. Let me tell you, I've talked to a lot of people who are like, "Man, when these things come back on the market, I'm buying 2 or 3 of them."
Nice.
So you're gonna have your hands full.
Yeah, that'll be great for me.
I'm curious, before we go, what is it you do aside from making cave packs?
Well, my job for the last 15 years was officially stay-at-home dad.
Oh, nice.
And then once my son was, when he started kindergarten, I started driving his school bus. So I drove school bus for 9 years until he got to high school. So he started high school, and my daughter, when she got out of elementary school. So basically, I drove the kids' elementary school bus throughout their elementary school careers. And then quit that, I guess, last year. My daughter will start seventh grade this year. So I worked, I've had a bunch of silly jobs. You know, right now, I'm working at the airport, you know, marshaling planes and throwing bags around and that sort of thing. But just part-time stuff.
So, and part-time cave pack maker.
Yep, that's it.
Excellent. Well, we're looking forward to hearing more news. Again, you can follow Swago on Facebook, and whenever he gets something worth posting, he'll put it up there. Scott, thanks for coming on the Caving Podcast. My hope is that it won't be the last time and we can do a full interview sometime.
Yeah, that'd be great. Love to.
All right. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Thank you.
Scott McRae, still trying to find a way to get Swago's back on the market. And full disclosure, of course, he sponsors this show. So support the Caving Podcast by supporting Swago. Visit swagogear.com for his other products like chicken loops, rope traps, sight lights, and sight light shields for your Cintos. And also grab some stickers while you're there. The more we support Swago now, the better chance we'll have of getting those packs back on the market. We're all rooting for you, Scott. And of course, don't forget to visit Organic Robot on Etsy for some really great caving and outdoor-related t-shirts. Many of Charlie's designs have won awards at the convention salon, and many of them are available on moisture-wicking fabrics, my favorite. I've got several of them myself, and I wear them all the time. You can find them on Etsy under Organic Robot, all one word. And, of course, you can buy shirts from Organic Robot and gear from Intermountain Outfitters on site this weekend at Indiana Cave Capers in Corydon, Indiana at the Harrison County Fairgrounds. It's the 64th annual Indiana Cave Capers put on by my grotto, the Central Indiana Grotto. We'd love to see you there. And I would love to interview you for a quick 5-10 minutes at Capers this weekend. You can find me and get a free t-shirt in exchange for doing a quick interview. Well, that's it for this month. Thanks for finding the Caving Podcast. We release new episodes on the first of every month. If you want to get a hold of me, you can email me at alpineproductions@gmail.com. alpineproductions@gmail.com. I'm always looking for people to reach out to me to maybe recommend people to interview for the podcast, or if you yourself would like to come on, that's great. We can set up a Skype interview, a FaceTime, phone maybe. I put together some phone audio for this month. We could do that, but I'd really like it to be higher quality. And as you heard from Scott's interview, it sounds pretty decent when you do it over FaceTime. That's what we used. So you don't have to come all the way to Indianapolis to get on the show. I would love to set something up to get you on. Well, that's it. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.